18, Elsa was able to rent a second apartment in her building, and she moved him in there to be her neighbor, charge, and companion. Elsa took great joy in foraging for the food he found comforting. She was resourceful and wealthy enough to commandeer the eggs and butter and bread he liked, even though the war made such staples hard to come by. Every day she cooked for him, doted on him, even found him cigars. Her parents helped as well by having them both over for comforting meals. The health of his younger son, Edward, was also precarious. Once again, he had fevers, and in early 1917 his lungs became inflamed. After receiving a pessimistic medical prognosis, Einstein lamented to Besso, "My little boy's condition depresses me greatly. It is impossible that he will become a fully developed person. Who knows if it wouldn't be better for him if he could depart before coming to know life properly." To Zanger he ruminated about the Spartans' method, leaving sickly children out on a mountain to die, but then said he could not accept that approach. Instead, he promised to pay whatever it took to get Edward care, and he told Zanger to send him to whatever treatment facility he thought best. "Even if you silently say to yourself that every effort is futile, send him anyway, so that my wife and my Albert think that something is being done." That summer, Einstein traveled back down to Switzerland to take Edward to a sanatorium in the Swiss village of Arosa. His ability to use science to rise above personal travails was illustrated in a letter he sent to his physicist friend, Paul Ehrenfest. "The little one is very sickly and must go to Arosa for a year. My wife is also ailing. Worries and more worries. Nevertheless, I have found a nice generalization of the Sommerfeld-Epstein quantum law." Hans Albert joined his father on the journey to take Edward to Arosa, and he then visited when Einstein was staying with his sister Maya and her husband Paul Winterle in Lucerne. There he found his father bedridden with stomach pains, but his uncle Paul took him hiking. Gradually, with a few rough patches, Einstein's relationship with his older son was being restored. "The letter from my Albert was the greatest joy I've had for the past year," he told Zanger. "I sense with bliss the intimate tie between us." Financial worries were also easing. "I received a prize of 1,500 crowns from the Viennese Academy, which we can use for Tete's cure." Now that he had moved into the same building as Elsa, and she was nursing him back to health, it was inevitable that the issue of a divorce from Marich would arise again. In early 1918, it did. "My desire to put my private affairs in some state of order prompts me to suggest a divorce to you for a second time," he wrote. "I am resolved to do everything to make this step possible." This time his financial offer was even more generous. He would pay her 9,000 marks, rather than what had now become a 6,000 annual stipend, with the provision that 2,000 would go into a fund for their children. Einstein's salary after tax was 13,000 marks. Inflation was beginning to set in, and the value of the German mark had fallen from 24 cents in 1914 to 19 cents in January 1918. One mark at the time would buy 2 dozen eggs or 4 loaves of bread. A year later, the mark would be worth only 12 cents. And when hyperinflation began to rage in January 1920, only 2 cents. Marich's stipend of 6,000 marks in January 1918 was thus worth about $1,140, or just under $15,000 in inflation-adjusted $2,006. His proposal was to increase this by 50%. Then he added an amazing new inducement. He was convinced, with good reason, that he would someday win the Nobel Prize. Even though the scientific community had not yet fully come to grips with special relativity, much less his new and unproven theory of general relativity, eventually it would, or his groundbreaking insights into light quanta and the photoelectric effect would be recognized. And so he made a striking offer to Marich. "The Nobel Prize, in the event of the divorce and the event that it is bestowed upon me, would be ceded to you in full." It was a financially enticing wager. The Nobel Prize was then, as it is now, very lucrative, indeed huge. In 1918, it was worth about 135,000 Swedish kroner, or 225,000 German marks, more than 37 times what Marich was getting annually. In addition, the German mark was starting to collapse, but the Nobel would be paid in stable Swedish currency. Most poignantly, there would be some symbolic justice. She had helped Einstein with the math and proofreading and domestic support for his 1905 papers, and now she could reap some of the reward. At first, she was furious. "Exactly 2 years ago, such letters pushed me over the brink into misery, which I still can't get over," she replied. "Why do you torment me so endlessly? I really don't deserve this from you." But within a few days, she began to assess the situation more clinically. Her life had reached a low point. She suffered pains, anxieties, and depression. Her younger son was in a sanatorium. The sister who had come to help her succumbed to depression and had been committed to an asylum. And her brother, who was serving as a medic in the Austrian army, had been captured by the Russians. Perhaps an end to the battles with her husband and the chance of financial security might, in fact, be best for her. So she discussed the option with her neighbor, Emil Surcher, who was a lawyer and a friend. A few days later, she decided to take the deal. "Have your lawyer write Dr. Surcher about how he envisions it, how the contract should be," she replied. "I must leave upsetting things to objective persons. I do not want to stand in the way of your happiness, if you are so resolved." The negotiations proceeded through letters and third parties through April. "I'm curious what will last longer, the World War or our divorce proceedings," he complained lightly at one point. But as things were progressing the way he wanted, he merrily added, "In comparison, this little matter of ours is still much the more pleasant. Amiable greetings to you and kisses to the boys." The main issue was money. Marich complained to a friend that Einstein was being stingy. In fact, he wasn't, because of Elsa. "Elsa's very greedy," Marich charged. "Her two sisters are very rich, and she's always envious of them." Letters went back and forth over exactly how the prospective Nobel Prize money would be paid, what right the children would have to it, what would happen to it if she remarried, and even what compensation he would offer in the unlikely event that the prize was never awarded to him. Another contentious issue was whether his sons could visit him in Berlin. On barring that, Marich held firm. Finally, at the end of April, he surrendered this final point. "I'm giving in about the children because I now believe you want to handle matters in a conciliatory manner," he said. "Maybe you will later take the view that the boys can come here without reservation. For the time being, I will see them in Switzerland." Given Marich's poor health, Einstein had tried to work out another option for the two boys, having them live in nearby Lucerne with his sister Maya and her husband Paul Winterler. The Winterlers were willing to take custody of their nephews, and they took the train to Bern one day to see if this could be arranged. But when they arrived, Zanger was away, and they wanted his help before discussing things with Marich. So Paul went over to see his feisty sister Anna, who was married to Michele Besso, to see if they could have a room for the night. He had planned not to tell Anna the purpose of their mission, as she had a protective attitude toward Marich and a hair-trigger sense of righteous indignation. "But she guessed the purpose of our coming," Maya reported to Einstein, and when Paul confirmed her suspicions, a torrent of accusations, scoldings, and threats poured forth. So Einstein wrote a letter to Anna to try to enlist her support. Marich, he argued, was incapable of running a household, given her condition. It would be best if Hans Albert went to live with Maya and Paul, he argued. Eduard could either do the same or stay in a mountain air clinic until his health improved. Einstein would pay for it all, including Marich's costs in a sanatorium in Lucerne, where she could see her sons every day. Unfortunately, Einstein made the mistake of ending the letter by pleading with Anna to help resolve the situation so that he could marry Elsa and end the shame that their relationship was causing her daughters. "Think of the two young girls, whose prospects of getting married are being hampered," he said. "Do put in a good word for me sometime to Misa, Marich, and make it clear to her how unkind it is to complicate the lives of others pointlessly." Anna shot back that Elsa was the one being selfish. "If Elsa had not wanted to make herself so vulnerable, she should not have run after you so conspicuously." In truth, Anna was quite difficult, and she soon had a falling out with Marich as well. "She tried to meddle in my affairs in a way that reveals potential human malice," Marich complained to Einstein. At the very least, this helped improve relations between the Einsteins. I see from your letter that you have also had problems with Anna Besso, he wrote Marich, just after they had agreed to the divorce terms. She has written me such impertinent letters that I put an end to further correspondence. It would be a few more months before the divorce decree could become final, but now that the negotiations were complete, everyone seemed relieved that there would be closure. Marich's health improved enough so that the children would remain with her, and the letters back and forth from Berlin to Zurich became friendlier. A satisfactory relationship has formed between me and my wife through the correspondence about the divorce, he told Sanger. A funny opportunity indeed for reconciliation. This détente meant that Einstein had an option for his summer vacation of 1918. Visit his children in Zurich, or have a less stressful holiday with Elsa. He chose the latter, partly because his doctor recommended against the altitude, and for 7 weeks he and Elsa stayed in the Baltic Sea resort of Arendschup. He brought along some light beach reading, Immanuel Kant's Prolegomena, spent countless hours pondering the quantum problem, and gloried in relaxing and recovering from his stomach ailments. No telephones, no responsibilities, absolute tranquility, he wrote to a friend. I am lying on the shore like a crocodile, allowing myself to be roasted by the sun. Never see a newspaper, and do not give a hoot about the so-called world. From this unlikely vacation, he sought to mollify Hans Albert, who had written to say he missed his father. Write me, please, why you aren't coming, at least, he asked. Einstein's explanation was sad and very defensive. You can easily imagine why I could not come. This winter I was so sick that I had to lie in bed for over 2 months. Every meal must be cooked separately for me. I may not make any abrupt movements, so I'd have been allowed neither to go on a walk with you nor to eat at the hotel. Added to this that I had quarreled with Anna Besso and that I did not want to become a burden to Mr. Zanger again, and finally, that I doubted whether my coming mattered much to you. His son was understanding. He wrote him letters filled with news and ideas, including a description and sketch of an idea he had for a pendulum inside a monorail that would swing and break the electric circuit whenever the train tilted too much. Einstein had rebuked Hans Albert unfairly for not finding some way to visit him in Germany during the vacation. That would have required Marich to waive the provision in their separation agreement that barred such trips, and it would also have been sadly impractical. My coming to Germany would be almost more impossible than your coming here, Hans Albert wrote, because in the end I am the only one in the family who can shop for anything. So Einstein, yearning to be nearer to his boys, found himself briefly tempted to move back to Zurich. During his Baltic vacation that summer of 1918, he considered a combined offer from the University of Zurich and his old Zurich Polytechnic. You can design your position here exactly as you wish, the physicist Edgar Meyer wrote. As Einstein jokingly noted to Besso, how happy I would have been 18 years ago with a measly assistantship. Einstein admitted that he was tormented by the decision. Zurich was his true home, and Switzerland was the only country for which he felt any affinity. Plus, he would be near his sons. But there was one rub. If he moved close to his sons, he would be moving close to their mother. Even for Einstein, who was good at shielding himself from personal emotions, it would be hard to set up household with Elsa in the same town as his first wife. My major personal difficulties would persist if I pitched my tent in Zurich again, he told Besso, although it does seem tempting to be close to my children. Elsa was also adamantly opposed to the prospect, even appalled. She begged Einstein to promise it would not happen. Einstein could be quite solicitous about Elsa's desires, and so he backed away from a full-time move to Zurich. Instead, he did something he usually avoided. He compromised. He retained his position in Berlin, but agreed to be a guest lecturer in Zurich, making month-long visits there twice a year. That, he thought, would give him the best of both worlds. In what seemed like an excess of Swiss caution, the Zurich authorities approved the lecture contract, which paid Einstein his expenses, but no fee, by way of experiment. They were, in fact, wise. Einstein's lectures were initially very popular, but eventually attendance dwindled and they would be cancelled after 2 years. The Social Democrat. Which would finish first, Einstein had wondered, half-jokingly, to Marich, the World War or their divorce proceedings? As it turned out, both came to a messy resolution at the end of 1918. As the German Reich was crumbling that November, a revolt by sailors in Kiel mushroomed into a general strike and popular uprising. Class canceled because of revolution, Einstein noted in his lecture diary on November 9th, the day that protesters occupied the Reichstag and the Kaiser abdicated. 4 days later, a worker-student revolutionary council took over the University of Berlin and jailed its deans and rector. With the outbreak of war, Einstein had become, for the first time, an outspoken public figure, advocating internationalism, European federalism, and resistance to militarism. Now the coming of peace turned Einstein's political thinking toward more domestic and social issues. From his youth, as an admirer of Jost Winterler and a friend of Friedrich Adler, Einstein had been attracted to the ideal of socialism as well as that of individual freedom. The revolution in Berlin, led by a collection of socialists, workers' councils, communists, and others on the left, caused him to confront cases when these two ideals conflicted. For the rest of his life, Einstein would expound a democratic socialism that had a liberal, anti-authoritarian underpinning. He advocated equality, social justice, and the taming of capitalism. He was a fierce defender of the underdog. But to the extent that any revolutionaries edged over toward a Bolshevik desire to impose centralized control, or to the extent that a regime such as Russia's struck him as authoritarian, Einstein's instinctive love of individual liberty usually provoked a disdainful reaction. Socialism to him reflects the ethical desire to remove the appalling chasm between the classes and to produce a more just economic system, his stepson-in-law wrote of Einstein's attitudes during the 1920s. And yet he cannot accept a socialist program. He appreciates the adventure of solitude and the happiness of freedom too much to welcome a system that threatens completely to eliminate the individual. It was an attitude that remained constant. Einstein's basic political philosophy did not undergo any significant changes during his lifetime, said Otto Nathan, a socialist, who became a close friend and then literary executor after Einstein moved to America. He welcomed the revolutionary development of Germany in 1918 because of his interest in socialism, and particularly because of his profound and unqualified devotion to democracy. Basic to his political thinking was the recognition of the dignity of the individual and the protection of political and intellectual freedom. When the student revolutionaries in Berlin jailed their rector and deans, Einstein got to put this philosophy into practice. The physicist Max Born was in bed that day with the flu when his telephone rang. It was Einstein. He was heading over to the university to see what he could do to get the rector and deans released, and he insisted that Born get out of bed and join him. They also enlisted a third friend, the pioneering Gestalt psychologist Max Wertheimer, perhaps in the belief that his specialty might be more useful than theoretical physics in accomplishing the task. The three took the tram from Einstein's apartment to the Reichstag, where the students were meeting. At first, their way was blocked by a dense mob, but the crowd parted once Einstein was recognized, and they were ushered to a conference room where the student Soviet was meeting. The chairman greeted them and asked them to wait while the group finished hammering out their new statutes for governing the university. Then he turned to Einstein. "Before we come to your request to speak, Professor Einstein, may I be permitted to ask what you think of the new regulations?" Einstein paused for a moment. Some people are innately conditioned to hedge their words, try to please their listeners, and enjoy the comfort that comes from conforming. Not Einstein. Instead, he responded critically, "I have always thought that the German university's most valuable institution is academic freedom, whereby the lecturers are in no way told what to teach, and the students are able to choose what lectures to attend without much supervision and control," he said. "Your new statutes seem to abolish all of this. I would be very sorry if the old freedom were to come to an end." At that point, Born recalled, The high and mighty young gentleman sat in perplexed silence. That did not help his mission. After some discussion, the students decided that they did not have the authority to release the rector and deans. So Einstein and company went off to the Reich Chancellor's palace to seek out someone who did. They were able to find the new German president, who seemed harried and baffled and perfectly willing to scribble a note ordering the release. It worked. The trio succeeded in springing their colleagues, and, as Born recalled, we left the Chancellor's palace in high spirits, feeling that we had taken part in a historical event and hoping to have seen the last of Prussian arrogance. Einstein then went down the street to a mass meeting of the revived New Fatherland League, where he delivered a 2-page speech that he had carried with him to his confrontation with the students. Calling himself an old-time believer in democracy, he again made clear that his socialist sentiments did not make him sympathetic to Soviet-style controls. All true Democrats must stand guard, lest the old class tyranny of the right be replaced by a new class tyranny of the left, he said. Some on the left insisted that democracy, or at least multi-party liberal democracy, needed to be put aside until the masses could be educated and a new revolutionary consciousness take hold. Einstein disagreed. Do not be seduced by feelings that a dictatorship of the proletariat is temporarily needed in order to hammer the concept of freedom into the heads of our fellow countrymen, he told the rally. Instead, he decried Germany's new left-wing government as dictatorial, and he demanded that it immediately call open elections, thereby eliminating all fears of a new tyranny as soon as possible. Years later, when Adolf Hitler and his Nazis were in power, Einstein would ruefully look back on that day in Berlin. Do you still remember the occasion some 25 years ago when we went together to the Reichstag building, convinced that we could turn the people there into honest Democrats, he wrote Born. How naive we were for men of 40. Marrying Elsa. Just after the war ended, so did Einstein's divorce proceedings. As part of the process, he had to give a deposition admitting adultery. On December 23, 1918, he appeared before a court in Berlin, stood before a magistrate, and declared, I have been living together with my cousin, the widow Elsa Einstein, divorced Lowenthal, for about 4.5 years, and have been continuing these intimate relations since then. As if to prove it, he brought Elsa when he traveled to Zurich the following month to deliver his first set of lectures there. His opening talks, unlike his later ones, were so well attended that to Einstein's annoyance, an official was posted at the door to prevent unauthorized auditors from getting in. Hans Albert came to visit him at his hotel, presumably when Elsa was not there, and Einstein spent a few days in Arosa, where Eduard was still recuperating in a sanatorium. Einstein stayed in Zurich through February 14th, when he stood before 3 local magistrates who granted his final divorce decree. It included the provisions regarding his prospective Nobel Prize award. In his deposition, Einstein had given his religion as dissenter, but in the divorce decree the clerk designated him Mosaic. Marić was also designated Mosaic, even though she had been born and remained a Serbian Orthodox Christian. As was customary, the decree included the order that the defendant, Einstein, is restrained from entering into a new marriage for the period of 2 years. Einstein had no intention of obeying that provision. He had decided that he would marry Elsa, and he would end up doing so within 4 months. His decision to remarry was accompanied by a drama that was, if true, weird even by the standards of his unusual family dynamics. It involved Elsa Einstein's daughter Ilse and the pacifist physician and adventurer Georg Nikolai. Ilse, then 21, was the elder of Elsa's 2 daughters. Einstein had hired her as the secretary for the unbuilt Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Physics that he was supposed to be creating. The only scientist who had been hired so far was his faithful astronomer, Freundlich. A spirited, idealistic, swan-like beauty, Ilse's mystique was enhanced by the fact that she had as a child lost the use of an eye in an accident. Like a moth to flame, she was attracted to radical politics and fascinating men. Thus, it was not surprising that she fell for Georg Nikolai, who had collaborated with Einstein in 1914 on the pacifist response to the German intellectuals' appeal to the cultured world. Among other things, Nikolai was a doctor specializing in electrocardiograms, who had occasionally treated Elsa. A brilliant egomaniac with a serious sexual appetite, he had been born in Germany and had lived in Paris and Russia. During one visit to Russia, he kept a list of the women he had sex with, totaling 16 in all, including two mother-daughter pairs. Ilse fell in love with Nikolai and with his politics. In addition to being, at least briefly, his lover, she helped type and distribute his protest letters. She also helped persuade Einstein to support the publication of Nikolai's pacifist tome, The Biology of War, which included their ill-fated 1914 manifesto and a collection of liberal writings by Kant and other classical German authors. Einstein had initially supported this publishing project, but in early 1917 had labeled the idea entirely hopeless. Nikolai, who had been drafted as a lowly medical orderly for the German army, somehow thought that Einstein would fund the endeavor, and he kept badgering him. "Nothing is more difficult than turning Nikolai down," Einstein wrote him, addressing him in the third person. "The man, who in other things is so sensitive that even grass growing is a considerable din to him, seems almost deaf when the sound involves a refusal." On one of Ilse's visits to see Nikolai, she told him that Einstein was now planning to marry her mother. Nikolai, an aficionado of the art of dating both mother and daughter, told Ilse that Einstein had it wrong. He should marry Ilse rather than her mother. It is unclear what psychological game he was playing with his young lover's mind, and it is likewise unclear what psychological game she was playing with his mind, or her own mind, when she wrote him a detailed letter saying that the Ilse or Elsa question had suddenly become a real one for Einstein. The letter is so striking and curious, it bears being quoted at length. "You are the only person to whom I can entrust the following, and the only one who can give me advice. You remember that we recently spoke about Albert's and Mama's marriage, and you told me that you thought a marriage between Albert and me would be more proper. I never thought seriously about it until yesterday. Yesterday the question was suddenly raised about whether Albert wished to marry Mama or me. This question, initially posed half in jest, became, within a few minutes, a serious matter, which must now be considered and discussed fully and completely. Albert himself is refusing to take any decision. He is prepared to marry either me or Mama. I know that Albert loves me very much, perhaps more than any other man ever will. He told me so himself yesterday. On the one hand, he might even prefer me as his wife, since I am young and he could have children with me, which naturally does not apply at all in Mama's case. But he is far too decent and loves Mama too much ever to mention it. You know how I stand with Albert. I love him very much. I have the greatest respect for him as a person. If ever there was true friendship and camaraderie between two beings of different types, those are quite certainly my feelings for Albert. I have never wished nor felt the least desire to be close to him physically. This is otherwise in his case, recently at least. He admitted to me once how difficult it is for him to keep himself in check. But now I do believe that my feelings for him are not sufficient for conjugal life." The third person still to be mentioned in this odd and certainly also highly comical affair would be Mother, for the present, because she does not yet firmly believe that I am really serious. She has allowed me to choose completely freely. If she saw that I could really be happy only with Albert, she would surely step aside out of love for me. But it would certainly be bitterly hard for her. And then I do not know whether it really would be fair if, after all her years of struggle, I were to compete with her over the place she had won for herself, now that she is finally at the goal. Philistines, like the grandparents, are naturally appalled about these new plans. Mother would supposedly be disgraced and other unpleasant things. Albert also thought that if I did not wish to have a child of his, it would be nicer for me not to be married to him. And I truly do not have this wish. It will seem peculiar to you that I, a silly little thing of a 20-year-old, should have to decide on such a serious matter. I can hardly believe it myself, and feel very unhappy doing so as well. Help me. Yours, Ilse. She wrote a big note on top of the first page. Please destroy this letter immediately after reading it. Nikolai didn't. Was it true? Was it half true? Was the truth relative to the observer? The only evidence we have of Einstein's mother-daughter dithering is this one letter. No one else, then or in recollections, ever mentioned the issue. The letter was written by an intense and love-struck young woman to a dashing philanderer whose attentions she craved. Perhaps it was merely her fantasy, or her ploy to provoke Nikolai's jealousy. As with much of nature, especially human nature, the underlying reality, if there is such a thing, may not be knowable. As it turned out, Einstein married Elsa in June 1919, and Ilse ended up remaining close to both of them. Einstein's family relations seemed to be improving on all fronts. The very next month, he went to Zurich to see his boys, and he stayed with Hans Albert at his first wife's apartment while she was away. Elsa seemed worried about that arrangement, but he reassured her in at least two letters that Marich would not be around much. Camping in the lioness's den is proving very worthwhile, he said in one, and there's no fear of any incident happening. Together, he and Hans Albert went sailing, played music, and built a model airplane together. The boy gives me indescribable joy, he wrote Elsa. He's very diligent and persistent in everything he does. He also plays piano very nicely. His relations with his first family were now so calm that during his July 1919 visit, he once again thought that maybe he should move there with Elsa and her daughters. This completely flummoxed Elsa, who made her feelings very clear. Einstein backed down. We're going to stay in Berlin, all right, he reassured her, so calm down and never fear. Einstein's new marriage was different from his first. It was not romantic or passionate. From the start, he and Elsa had separate bedrooms at opposite ends of their rambling Berlin apartment. Nor was it intellectual. Understanding relativity, she later said, is not necessary for my happiness. She was, on the other hand, talented in practical ways that often eluded her husband. She spoke French and English well, which allowed her to serve as his translator as well as manager when he traveled. I am not talented in any direction except perhaps as wife and mother, she said. My interest in mathematics is mainly in the household bills. That comment reflects her humility and a simmering insecurity, but it sells her short. It was no simple task to play the role of wife and mother to Einstein, who required both, nor to manage their finances and logistics. She did it with good sense and warmth. Even though every now and then she succumbed to a few pretenses that came with their standing, she generally displayed an unaffected manner and self-aware humor, and in doing so, she thus helped make sure that her husband retained those traits as well. The marriage was, in fact, a solid symbiosis, and it served adequately, for the most part, the needs and desires of both partners. Elsa was an efficient and lively woman who was eager to serve and protect him. She liked his fame, and, unlike him, did not try to hide that fact. She also appreciated the social standing it gave them, even if it meant she had to merrily shoo away reporters and other invaders of her husband's privacy. He was as pleased to be looked after as she was to look after him. She told him when to eat and where to go. She packed his suitcases and doled out his pocket money. In public, she was protective of the man she called the professor, or even simply Einstein. That allowed him to spend hours in a rather dreamy state, focusing more on the cosmos than on the world around him, all of which gave her excitement and satisfaction. The Lord has put into him so much that's beautiful, and I find him wonderful, even though life at his side is enervating and difficult, she once said. When Einstein was in one of his periods of intense work, as was often the case, Elsa recognized the need for keeping all disturbing elements away from him, a relative noted. She would make his favorite meal of lentil soup and sausages, summon him down from his study, and then would leave him alone as he mechanically ate his meal. But when he would mutter or protest, she would remind him that it was important for him to eat. People have centuries to find things out, she would say, but your stomach, no, it will not wait for centuries. She came to know from a faraway look in his eyes when he was seized with a problem, as she called it, and thus should not be disturbed. He would pace up and down in his study, and she would have food sent up. When his intense concentration was over, he would finally come down to the table for a meal, and sometimes ask to go on a walk with Elsa and her daughters. They always complied, but they never initiated such a request. "It is he who has to do the asking," a newspaper reported after interviewing her, "and when he asks them for a walk, they know that his mind is relieved of work." Elsa's daughter Ilse would eventually marry Rudolf Kaiser, editor of the premier literary magazine in Germany, and they set up a house filled with art and artists and writers. Margot, who liked sculpting, was so shy that she would sometimes hide under the table when guests of her father arrived. She lived at home even after she married, in 1930, a Russian named Dmitri Marianov. Both of these sons-in-law, it turned out, would end up writing florid but undistinguished books about the Einstein family. For the time being, Einstein and Elsa and her two daughters lived together in a spacious and somberly furnished apartment near the center of Berlin. The wallpaper was dark green, the tablecloths white linen with lace embroidery. "One felt that Einstein would always remain a stranger in such a household," said his friend and colleague Philip Frank, "a bohemian as a guest in a bourgeois home." In defiance of building codes, they converted three attic rooms into a garret study with a big new window. It was occasionally dusted, never tidied, and papers piled up under the benign gazes of Newton, Maxwell, and Faraday. There Einstein would sit in an old armchair, pad on his knee. Occasionally he would get up to pace, then he would sit back down to scribble the equations that would, he hoped, extend his theory of relativity into an explanation of the cosmos. Chapter 11. Einstein's Universe, 1916 to 1919. Cosmology and Black Holes, 1917. Cosmology is the study of the universe as a whole, including its size and shape, its history and destiny, from one end to the other, from the beginning to the end of time. That's a big topic. And it's not a simple one. It's not even simple to define what those concepts mean, or even if they have meaning. With the gravitational field equations in his general theory of relativity, Einstein laid the foundations for studying the nature of the universe, thereby becoming the primary founder of modern cosmology. Helping him in this endeavor, at least in the early stages, was a profound mathematician and even more distinguished astrophysicist, Karl Schwarzschild, who directed the Potsdam Observatory. He read Einstein's new formulation of general relativity, and at the beginning of 1916 set about trying to apply it to objects in space. One thing made Schwarzschild's work very difficult. He had volunteered for the German military during the war, and when he read Einstein's papers, he was stationed in Russia, projecting the trajectory of artillery shells. Nevertheless, he was also able to find time to calculate what the gravitational field would be, according to Einstein's theory, around an object in space. It was the wartime counterpart to Einstein's ability to come up with a special theory of relativity while examining patent applications for the synchronization of clocks. In January 1916, Schwarzschild mailed his result to Einstein with the declaration that it permitted his theory to shine with increased purity. Among other things, it reconfirmed, with greater rigor, the success of Einstein's equations in explaining Mercury's orbit. Einstein was thrilled. "I would not have expected that the exact solution to the problem could be formulated so simply," he replied. The following Thursday, he personally delivered the paper at the Prussian Academy's weekly meeting. Schwarzschild's first calculations focused on the curvature of space-time outside a spherical non-spinning star. A few weeks later, he sent Einstein another paper on what it would be like inside such a star. In both cases, something unusual seemed possible, indeed inevitable. If all the mass of a star, or any object, was compressed into a tiny enough space, defined by what became known as the Schwarzschild radius, then all of the calculations seemed to break down. At the center, space-time would infinitely curve in on itself. For our sun, that would happen if all of its mass were compressed into a radius of less than 2 miles. For the Earth, it would happen if all the mass were compressed into a radius of about 1/3 of an inch. What would that mean? In such a situation, nothing within the Schwarzschild radius would be able to escape the gravitational pull, not even light or any other form of radiation. Time would also be part of the warpage as well, dilated to zero. In other words, a traveler nearing the Schwarzschild radius would appear, to someone on the outside, to freeze to a halt. Einstein did not believe, then or later, that these results actually corresponded to anything real. In 1939, for example, he produced a paper that provided, he said, a clear understanding as to why these Schwarzschild singularities do not exist in physical reality. A few months later, however, J. Robert Oppenheimer and his student Hartland Snyder argued the opposite, predicting that stars could undergo a gravitational collapse. As for Schwarzschild, he never had the chance to study the issue further. Weeks after writing his papers, he contracted a horrible autoimmune disease while on the front, which ate away at his skin cells, and he died that May at age 42. As scientists would discover after Einstein's death, Schwarzschild's odd theory was right. Stars could collapse and create such a phenomenon, and in fact they often did. In the 1960s, physicists such as Stephen Hawking, Roger Penrose, John Wheeler, Freeman Dyson, and Kip Thorne showed that this was indeed a feature of Einstein's general theory of relativity, one that was very real. Wheeler dubbed them black holes, and they have been a feature of cosmology as well as Star Trek episodes ever since. Black holes have now been discovered all over the universe, including one at the center of our galaxy that is a few million times more massive than our sun. Black holes are not rare, and they are not an accidental embellishment of our universe, says Dyson. They are the only places in the universe where Einstein's theory of relativity shows its full power and glory. Here, and nowhere else, space and time lose their individuality and merge together in a sharply curved four-dimensional structure precisely delineated by Einstein's equations. Einstein believed that his general theory solved Newton's bucket issue in a way that Mach would have liked. Inertia, or centrifugal forces, would not exist for something spinning in a completely empty universe. Instead, inertia was caused only by rotation relative to all the other objects in the universe. According to my theory, inertia is simply an interaction between masses, not an effect in which space of itself is involved, separate from the observed mass, Einstein told Schwarzschild. It can be put this way. If I allow all things to vanish, then, according to Newton, the Galilean inertial space remains. Following my interpretation, however, nothing remains. Chapter 14 describes Einstein's revision of this view in a 1920 lecture in London. The issue of inertia got Einstein into a debate with one of the great astronomers of the time, Willem de Sitter of Leiden. Throughout 1916, Einstein struggled to preserve the relativity of inertia and Mach's principle by using all sorts of constructs, including assuming various border conditions, such as distant masses along the fringes of space that were, by necessity, unable to be observed. As de Sitter noted, that in itself would have been anathema to Mach, who railed against postulating things that could not possibly be observed. By February 1917, Einstein had come up with a new approach. "I have completely abandoned my views, rightly contested by you," he wrote to de Sitter. "I am curious to hear what you will have to say about the somewhat crazy idea I am considering now." It was an idea that initially struck him as so wacky that he told his friend Paul Ehrenfest in Leiden, "It exposes me to the danger of being confined to a madhouse." He jokingly asked Ehrenfest for assurances before he came to visit that there were no such asylums in Leiden. His new idea was published that month in what became yet another seminal Einstein paper, Cosmological Considerations in the General Theory of Relativity. On the surface, it did indeed seem to be based on a crazy notion. Space has no borders because gravity bends it back on itself. Einstein began by noting that an absolutely infinite universe filled with stars and other objects was not plausible. There would be an infinite amount of gravity tugging at every point and an infinite amount of light shining from every direction. On the other hand, a finite universe floating at some random location in space was inconceivable as well. Among other things, what would keep the stars and energy from flying off, escaping, and depleting the universe? So he developed a third option, a finite universe, but one without boundaries. The masses in the universe caused space to curve, and over the expanse of the universe they caused space, indeed the whole four-dimensional fabric of space-time, to curve completely in on itself. The system is closed and finite, but there is no end or edge to it. One method that Einstein employed to help people visualize this notion was to begin by imagining two-dimensional explorers on a two-dimensional universe, like a flat surface. These flatlanders can wander any direction on this flat surface, but the concept of going up or down has no meaning to them. Now imagine this variation. What if these flatlanders' two dimensions were still on a surface, but this surface was, in a way very subtle to them, gently curved? And what if they and their world were still confined to two dimensions, but their flat surface was like the surface of a globe? As Einstein put it, let us consider now a two-dimensional existence, but this time on a spherical surface instead of on a plane. An arrow shot by these flatlanders would still seem to travel in a straight line, but eventually it would curve around and come back, just as a sailor on the surface of our planet, heading straight off over the seas, would eventually return from the other horizon. The curvature of the flatlanders' two-dimensional space makes their surface finite, and yet they can find no boundaries. No matter what direction they travel, they reach no end or edge of their universe, but they eventually get back to the same place. As Einstein put it, the great charm resulting from this consideration lies in the recognition that the universe of these beings is finite and yet has no limits. And if the Flatlander's surface was like that of an inflating balloon, their whole universe could be expanding, yet there would still be no boundaries to it. By extension, we can try to imagine, as Einstein has us do, how three-dimensional space can be similarly curved to create a closed and finite system that has no edge. It's not easy for us three-dimensional creatures to visualize, but it is easily described mathematically by the non-Euclidean geometries pioneered by Gauss and Riemann. It can work for four dimensions of space-time as well. In such a curved universe, a beam of light starting out in any direction could travel what seems to be a straight line and yet still curve back on itself. This suggestion of a finite but unbounded space is one of the greatest ideas about the nature of the world which has ever been conceived, the physicist Max Born has declared. Yes, but what is outside this curved universe? What's on the other side of the curve? That's not merely an unanswerable question, it's a meaningless one. Just as it would be meaningless for a flatlander to ask what's outside her surface. One could speculate, imaginatively or mathematically, about what things are like in a fourth spatial dimension, but other than in science fiction, it is not very meaningful to ask what's in a realm that exists outside of the three spatial dimensions of our curved universe. This concept of the cosmos that Einstein derived from his general theory of relativity was elegant and magical. But there seemed to be one hitch, a flaw that needed to be fixed or fudged. His theory indicated that the universe would have to be either expanding or contracting, not staying static. According to his field equations, a static universe was impossible because the gravitational forces would pull all the matter together. This did not accord with what most astronomers thought they had observed. As far as they knew, the universe consisted only of our Milky Way galaxy, and it all seemed pretty stable and static. The stars appeared to be meandering gently, but not receding rapidly as part of an expanding universe. Other galaxies, such as Andromeda, were merely unexplained blurs in the sky. A few Americans working at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona had noticed that the spectra of some mysterious spiral nebulae were shifting to the red end of the spectrum, but scientists had not yet determined that these were distant galaxies, all speeding away from our own. When the conventional wisdom of physics seemed to conflict with an elegant theory of his, Einstein was inclined to question that wisdom rather than his theory, often to have his stubbornness rewarded. In this case, his gravitational field equations seemed to imply, indeed screamed out, that the conventional thinking about a stable universe was wrong and should be tossed aside, just as Newton's concept of absolute time was. Instead, this time he made what he called a slight modification to his theory. To keep the matter in the universe from imploding, Einstein added a repulsive force, a little addition to his general relativity equations to counterbalance gravity in the overall scheme. In his revised equations, this modification was signified by the Greek letter lambda, which he used to multiply his metric tensor, g sub mu nu, in a way that produced a stable static universe. In his 1917 paper, he was almost apologetic. "We admittedly had to introduce an extension of the field equations that is not justified by our actual knowledge of gravitation." He dubbed the new element the cosmological term, or the cosmological constant. Kosmologische Gleit was the phrase he used. Later, when it was discovered that the universe was in fact expanding, Einstein would call it his biggest blunder. Chapter 14 describes Einstein's decision to renounce the term cosmological constant when he discovered the universe expanding. But even today, in light of evidence that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, it is considered a useful concept, indeed a necessary one after all. During 5 months of 1905, Einstein had upended physics by conceiving light quanta, special relativity, and statistical methods for showing the existence of atoms. Now he had just completed a more prolonged creative slog, from the fall of 1915 to the spring of 1917, which Dennis Overby has called arguably the most prodigious effort of sustained brilliance on the part of one man in the history of physics. His first burst of creativity as a patent clerk had appeared to involve remarkably little anguish. But this later one was an arduous and intense effort, one that left him exhausted and racked with stomach pains. During this period, he generalized relativity, found the field equations for gravity, found a physical explanation for light quanta, hinted at how the quanta involved probability rather than certainty, and came up with a concept for the structure of the universe as a whole, described in Chapter 14. From the smallest thing conceivable, the quantum, to the largest, the cosmos itself, Einstein had proven a master. The Eclipse, 1919. For general relativity, there was a dramatic experimental test that was possible, one that had the potential to dazzle and help heal a war-weary world. It was based on a concept so simple that everyone could understand it. Gravity would bend light's trajectory. Specifically, Einstein predicted the degree to which light from a distant star would be observed to curve as it went through the strong gravitational field close to the sun. To test this, astronomers would have to plot precisely the position of a star in normal conditions. Then they would wait until the alignments were such that the path of light from that star passed right next to the sun. Did the star's position seem to shift? There was one exciting challenge. This observation required a total eclipse, so that the stars would be visible and could be photographed. Fortunately, nature happened to make the size of the sun and moon just properly proportional, so that every few years there are full eclipses observable at times and places that make them ideally suited for such an experiment. Einstein's 1911 paper on the influence of gravity on the propagation of light, and his Entwerf equations the following year, had calculated that light would undergo a deflection of approximately, allowing for some data correction subsequently made, 0.85 arc-second when it passed near the sun, which was the same as would be predicted by an emission theory such as Newton's that treated light as particles. As previously noted, the attempt to test this during the August 1914 eclipse in the Crimea had been aborted by the war, so Einstein was saved the potential embarrassment of being proved wrong. Now, according to the field equations he formulated at the end of 1915, which accounted for the curvature of space-time caused by gravity, he had come up with twice that deflection. Light passing next to the sun should be bent, he said, by about 1.7 arc-seconds. In his 1916 popular book on relativity, Einstein issued yet another call for scientists to test this conclusion. Stars ought to appear to be displaced outwards from the sun by 1.7 seconds of arc, as compared with their apparent position in the sky when the sun is situated at another part of the heavens, he said. The examination of the correctness or otherwise of this deduction is a problem of the greatest importance, the early solution of which is to be expected of astronomers. Willem de Sitter, the Dutch astrophysicist, had managed to send a copy of Einstein's general relativity paper across the English Channel in 1916 in the midst of the war and get it to Arthur Eddington, who was the director of the Cambridge Observatory. Einstein was not well known in England, where scientists then took pride in either ignoring or denigrating their German counterparts. Eddington became an exception. He embraced relativity enthusiastically and wrote an account in English that popularized the theory, at least among scholars. Eddington consulted with the astronomer royal Sir Frank Dyson and came up with the audacious idea that a team of English scientists should prove the theory of a German, even as the two nations were at war. In addition, it would help solve a personal problem for Eddington. He was a Quaker, and because of his pacifist faith, faced imprisonment for refusing military service in England. In 1918, he was 35 years old, still subject to conscription. Dyson was able to convince the British Admiralty that Eddington could best serve his nation by leading an expedition to test the theory of relativity during the next full solar eclipse. That eclipse would occur on May 29, 1919, and Dyson pointed out that it would be a unique opportunity. The sun would then be amid the rich star cluster known as the Hyades, which we ordinary stargazers recognize as the center of the constellation Taurus. But it would not be convenient. The eclipse would be most visible in a path that stretched across the Atlantic near the equator from the coast of Brazil to equatorial Africa. Nor would it be easy. As the expedition was being considered in 1918, there were German U-boats in the region, and their commanders were more interested in the control of the seas than in the curvature of the cosmos. Fortunately, the war ended before the expeditions began. In early March 1919, Eddington sailed from Liverpool with two teams. One group split off to set up their cameras in the isolated town of Sobral in the Amazon jungle of northern Brazil. The second group, which included Eddington, sailed for the tiny island of Principe, a Portuguese colony a degree north of the equator just off the Atlantic coast of Africa. Eddington set up his equipment on a 500-foot bluff at the island's north tip. The eclipse was due to begin just after 3:13 p.m. local time on Principe and last about 5 minutes. That morning it rained heavily, but as the time of the eclipse approached, the sky started to clear. The heavens insisted on teasing and tantalizing Eddington at the most important minutes of his career, with the remaining clouds cloaking and then revealing the elusive sun. I did not see the eclipse, being too busy changing plates, except for one glance to make sure it had begun, and another halfway through to see how much cloud there was, Eddington noted in his diary. He took 16 photographs. They are all good of the sun, showing a very remarkable prominence, but the cloud has interfered with the star images. In his telegram back to London that day, he was more telegraphic. Through cloud, hopeful, Eddington. The team in Brazil had better weather, but the final results had to wait until all the photographic plates from both places could be shipped back to England, developed, measured, and compared. That took until September, with Europe's scientific cognoscenti waiting eagerly. To some spectators, it took on the post-war political coloration of a contest between the English theory of Newton, predicting about 0.85 arcsecond deflection, and the German theory of Einstein, predicting a 1.7 arcseconds deflection. The photo finish did not produce an immediately clear result. One set of particularly good pictures taken in Brazil showed a deflection of 1.98 arcseconds. Another instrument, also at the Brazil location, produced photographs that were a bit blurrier because heat had affected its mirror. They indicated a 0.86 deflection, but with a higher margin of error. And then there were Eddington's own plates from Principe. These showed fewer stars, so a series of complex calculations were used to extract some data. They seemed to indicate a deflection of about 1.6 arcseconds. The predictive power of Einstein's theory, the fact that it offered up a testable prediction, perhaps exercised a power over Eddington, whose admiration for the mathematical elegance of the theory caused him to believe in it deeply. He discarded the lower value coming out of Brazil, contending that the equipment was faulty, and with a slight bias toward his own fuzzy results from Africa, got an average of just over 1.7 arcseconds, matching Einstein's predictions. It wasn't the cleanest confirmation, but it was enough for Eddington, and it turned out to be valid. He later referred to getting these results as the